Good to be with you this morning. Really is good to see Franz back with us, as he has been now for a few weeks. I was thinking about him in the first song. I always enjoy your song selections, Brian, and Franz would often open with Humble Yourselves. That's such a powerful opening song. And down the road, I'd really like to hear you lead us in that again. All right, for our subject today, first, let's mention what's going to be studied tonight. When Jonathan speaks to us this evening at 5 o'clock, it'll be from Isaiah chapter 40. All flesh shall see. He said there's an interesting prophecy in Isaiah 40 that many know the beginning to, but not many realize the ending and its significance. And he's going to be leading us in a study about that prophecy and looking at its fulfillment today. So please be here for that at 5 o'clock. And today, we're going to be looking at one of the Beatitudes. Matthew chapter 5. I'm not going to read the extended parts of each of them, but just hitting the statements. We've got, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the pure in heart. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. This is the one we're going to be looking at today. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. This is a lesson I've been doing elsewhere recently, and if you are an oxygen-intaking, carbon dioxide-producing human being, you need all of the Beatitudes. And if you, like me, ever find yourself being a friction increaser or trouble causer instead of peacemaker, then you need this focus on this verse. In fact, you can think about the Beatitudes in their reverse. You know, it's back in Leviticus, you remember there were the blessings and the cursings. Blessed are the poor in spirit, so cursed are the arrogant. Blessed are they that mourn, so cursed are the calloused and unapologetic, and on and on. And so when we get to blessed are the peacemakers, we have to look at how we react and be called to this and do better. Peacemaking, we want to talk just a little bit to introduce the topic before we get into our main illustrations of it from Scripture. But let's remember what Jesus did in making peace. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6 says, unto us a child is born. And remember the different descriptions of him. What's the last one? Prince of Peace. Isaiah chapter 53, verse 5. In that chapter where it talks about he was wounded on transgressions, the chastening or the punishment of our peace was upon him. And if you look at Ephesians chapter 2, verse 11 through 18, we're not going to read that whole text, but let's scan over and get a little bit of it. Ephesians chapter 2, that chapter begins with the fact that we had sinned against God. We were dead in our sins. Or as Romans puts it in Romans chapter 5, we were what? Enemies. Enemies of God. That's not where we want to be. And that's not a peaceful place to be. But verse 11 says, wherefore remember that once you Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision, by that which is called circumcision, that is made with hands. Verse 12, at that time you were separate from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers from the covenants. And it says at the end, verse 12, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you once that were far off are made nigh in the blood of Christ. And you see it in verse 14. He is our peace, who made both one and broke down the middle wall of partition. And it says at the end of verse 15, of the two, Jew and Gentile, making one new man, making peace And in verse 16, reconciling us to God by his paying for our sins. So verse 17, he came and preached peace. So he gives peace. And we need to have peace. Look at James chapter 3. We need to accept this peace from God. We need to be operating in peace and helping other people be peace. But this is where we can end up going. Verse 14. If you have bitter jealousy and faction in your heart, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom is not a wisdom that comes down from above, but it's earthly, sensual, devilish. Where jealousy and faction are, there is confusion in every vile deed. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without variance, without hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace for them that do what? Make peace. James several times refers to the Beatitudes. In the next chapter, he's going to talk about being pure in heart. He's going to talk about mourning. And here, he echoes his brother Jesus' words about making peace. Romans chapter 12, verse 18 says, as much as possible, as much as lies within you, be at peace with all men. Now, why is there a qualification there? There's some people that don't want to be at peace with you. There may be somebody at work that no matter what you do, they don't want to be at peace with you. You may have a neighbor, and no matter what you do, they don't want to be at peace with you. You may have somebody in your family, and no matter how much you try, they don't want to be at peace with you. Well, it's not your job to be responsible for them, but it's our job to be responsible for ourselves. And that's not always easy. Because you know when we like being peaceful? I like being peaceful when people are peaceful with me. I like that. I don't always like being peaceful when people aren't being peaceful with me. But that's ungodly. As much as lies within us, we need to be at peace with other people. Jesus made peace with us. We need to be looking for peace with others. Blessed are the peacemakers. We're going to look at an example out of 1 Samuel 25. We're going to be looking in Matthew 5 and a little bit in 7, principles of peacemaking there. Then we're going to look at Philippians 2. And depending on if we have time, we'll say a few words at the end about apologies. But we're going to start with 1 Samuel chapter 25. This is a really good example of a peacemaker. 1 Samuel 25, Abigail. Now, if you remember the setting, Saul is trying to kill David. David has been anointed by Samuel to be the next king. Saul has been rejected as being king. But Saul's pursuing David. He knows that David is popular among the people. He wants to kill him. He's got jealousy and faction and every vile deed and confusion going on. And so he's taken 3,000 men and he's out chasing after David. That was back in chapter 24. And you remember, David had the chance to kill Saul, but he doesn't. He will not lift his hand against the Lord's anointed. Saul realizes, you're better than me. Good realization. Unfortunately, in the next chapter, he's going to come after him again with 3,000 men and try to kill him. So recognizing we have a problem is not the same thing as correcting a problem. But we have an interesting story in between here. David, who won't lift his hand against the Lord's anointed, Saul, who's absolutely not being a peacemaker, we have chapter 25. Samuel has just died. David rose, went down into the wilderness of Paran, and there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. I'm in the middle of 1 Samuel 25, verse 2. And we're going to be looking at a good bit of this text, so you might want to have your Bible out. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now, the man's name was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men. David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus shall you greet him. Peace be to you." Shalom, you know, is a Hebrew word for peace. And shalom, you know, peace be to you. Peace be to your house. Peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shears. Now your shepherds have been with us and we did them no harm. They missed nothing all the time that they were in Carmel. By the way, when an army comes through, do they usually make sure nobody misses anything? No. There's disputes about how it all started, but one story about how things got started at the Battle of Gettysburg was that some of the Confederates came into town looking for shoes. Were they going to go to the shoe shop and buy a few shoes? No. The armies come through and they take stuff. He says, "We didn't do that." Ask your young men, they will tell you. "Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David." When David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and they waited. Nabal says, "Who is David? Who is this son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I've killed for my shears and give it to men who come from I do not know where?" So David's young men turned away and came back and told David all this. Now, let's see what David does. You remember what David did in the last chapter? Saul's trying to kill him. David refuses to take advantage of that. This time, though, he's kind of had it. David said, "Every man strap on his sword." Every man strapped on his sword. David strapped on his sword. About 400 men went up after David. 200 remained with the baggage. Now, some of the servants had come and tell Abigail, because there's a bright person in this family that's not Nabal. They come and they tell Abigail and say, "Listen, this is what's happened. These people treated us really well. And it said, you know, they were heads to us. They protected us. They never took anything from us. You know, this is not going to be good. Think about what you're going to do." Verse 18. And he says, at the end of verse 17, "Harm is determined against our master and against all his house, and he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him." Verse 18, "Abigail made host, took 200 loaves, 2 skins of wine, and 5 sheep, and prepared all these different things, cakes of figs, etc., put them on donkeys, and she sends it before them, and says, 'Go on before me,' but she didn't tell Nabal, and she rode her donkey, and here comes David and all his men." Verse 21, "David said, 'Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned to me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David, and more so if by morning I leave so much as 1 male to all that belong to him.'" So, what's his frustration? "I did him good, and he did me evil. So now what's it time for? Now it's time for evil." How many times have we thought that way ourselves? And we're focused on which part. I did good and they did evil. And then what do we end up doing? Here comes Abigail. "When Abigail saw David, she hurried, got down from the donkey, fell before David on her face, bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, 'On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let me speak in your ears in the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so Nabal is his name, and folly is with him." That's what his name indicates. And she says, "But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, because the Lord," watch this, "because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand. Now then, let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to you, be to my lord, be as Nabal. And then she gives him the food for his men and everything. And then she talks about, I know, you know, that basically God has blessed you and you're going to do well. And she talks favorably in those ways and everything. But she says in verse 30, when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has done, spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord will have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord working salvation himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant. When she walked up, had David decided he wasn't going to do anything? No, David had decided he was. Everybody, all the males were going to die. He was going to kill them all. And Abigail's letting herself be used to restrain him from this blood guiltiness. David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion. Blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. For as surely as the Lord of God Israel lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me truly by morning, there had not been Nabal left so much as one male. Now, you know the rest of the story. When Nabal finds out what had almost happened, he dies. It's too much for him and he dies. And Abigail is actually going to marry David. But look what a magnificent peacemaker she was. By the way, was she at fault for anything? Maybe poor choice in a husband. But, you know, in this regard, she's not at fault for anything. But she's going to humble herself. She's going to get in the middle and she's going to make peace. Now let's look through Matthew chapter 5, and there's just so many principles in Matthew chapter 5 about peacemaking, right there in the same chapter here in the Sermon on the Mount. So, for example, verse 23 and 24. If you are offering your gift at the altar, and you remember that your brother has something against you, what does Jesus say to you? Leave your gift before the altar, go your way, first be reconciled to your brother. Then come offer your gift. Go. If there's a problem between you and a brother or sister, if they've got something against you, go. What's a peacemaker going to do? Go. Make peace. What did Abigail do? Go. Make peace. She didn't just sit back and say, well, I'm going to wait and see what happens. She goes and she makes peace. If somebody has something against you, go to them. Go. It says, if you're about to worship God and you realize, no, go. God doesn't want the worship of people that are not being peacemakers. He wants the worship of people who are doing what he said to do. And what he said to do is go to that person. Fix it. Make it right. And also, back up there, verse 25. Agree with your adversary quickly while you're with him in the way, lest happily the adversary deliver you to the judge, and the judge deliver you to the officer, and you be cast into prison. You might recall in the parable of the unmerciful servant, you know, you owe me this money, and he throws him into prison, that type of thing. If you owe some money to somebody, there's been some trouble, and so, go. Just fix that. Agree with them. Get it resolved. Verse 38 through 39. Again, you've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, resist not him that is evil. The Old Testament says, if I remember correctly, three times, an eye for an eye. And in each of them, it is within the context of a judicial setting. It'll talk about the judges, the witnesses. In Leviticus 19, it said, don't bear a grudge against your brother. Proverbs says, don't say, I'm going to do to him what he did to me. But there is a place for punishment to be carried out, and that's what courts are for. And they had systems like that. There would be judges, there would be witnesses, there would be village elders, and you let this be resolved there, and then a punishment not inflicted by you. And if it was I, then it was I. Eye for an eye, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't mean a personal vendetta. I say to you, resist not him that is evil, but whosoever smites you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. If any man would go to you and take away your coat, let him have your cloak also. Whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him two. We're going to talk in a minute about what I think this passage is not saying. But before we talk about what it's not saying, we need to pay attention to what it is saying. Sometimes we click too quickly, say, that doesn't mean this, that doesn't mean this, and we skip right over what it means. Somebody slaps you in the face. Your neighbor. Somebody at work. Your brother or sister for you siblings. You know, somebody slaps you in the face. What's your emotional reaction? Man, you know, and they started it, self-defense. You know what? You don't need to self-defend for a slap in the face. That's an insult. It's irritating. It stings. It's rude. You don't need to defend yourself about that. Take it. Jesus is not speaking figuratively here. All Jesus doesn't mean if they're trying to sue you and take your coat, give them your cloak also. He didn't mean that. Yes, he did. That's what he said. Listen to it again. If someone smites you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. If they would take you to law and take away your coat, let them have your cloak. If he compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. He's saying it within the context of don't render evil for evil. And when they do evil and they think you've done something wrong, instead of you doing evil back to them, you go overboard in correcting your end of it. Is that not what he's saying? Is it a strange allegory that he didn't mean it connects to real life? No, this is what he's saying to do. Sometimes we might make the point, well, you don't want to let yourself be used as a doormat. I don't want to be a doormat. You don't want to be a doormat. Sometimes we're going to have to be a doormat. You know what a doormat is for? Cleaning off your feet. What was Jesus in John chapter 13? He's down on the ground cleaning people's feet. Now let's talk about what it's not saying. It says, if somebody slaps you on the cheek, which is an insult, don't do evil for evil. Turn the other cheek. If somebody's going to sue you for your coat, let them also have your cloak. If they compel you to go 1 mile, go 2. You know what it didn't say? If somebody's strangling your wife, say, hey, don't forget the kids. You know, that's not an insult. That needs to be stopped. Don't do evil for evil, but stop that. You know, rescue your wife, rescue your children. It's not saying if somebody's suing you for, you know, $300, say, oh, here's the house, here's you know, my pension, here's, you know, my kids into slavery. No. It says if they're going to take your coat, let them have your cloak also. It doesn't say if that soldier tells you to go 1 mile, you have to go 1,000 miles and spend the rest of your life hauling the stuff. No, it said go another mile. I want to give you an example of this. Some of you heard this before. I've shared it in the past, but I think it's a really powerful example of this principle. So years ago, the Legs lived over on Swift Run Road. So there's a nice big farmhouse there. If you're ever driving along there, if you go through Hunterstown, it's on the right. They bricked it. Lori grew up there. It's a nice big farm. When they lived there, Wilson had cattle and was breeding cattle, he was also a pirate. Some of his cattle got through a fence, got into the neighbor's farm, and trampled down some corn. A neighbor, an opportunist neighbor, told the other guy, "Hey, he's an airline pilot. He's got money. You sue him. Take him to court. You know, ask for thousands of dollars." And so the fellow, you know, listening to bad advice, started to pursue that. But Wilson did something I think was really smart. He went to his neighbor. What does it say? Go. Did Wilson's cattle tramp down his corn? Yeah. Okay, so instead of, he went to him. You remember Proverbs 6? It talks about that. Go, go. And he asked him, he said, "How much corn got damaged?" And he said, "How many feet? You know, how many rows, how many feet?" And it wasn't very much. And the fellow was honest and said it was about this much. And then Wilson said, "In a good year, you know, what would you have gotten for that?" And I think the guy said, if I remember the details correctly, you know, like $150. And he said, "This year, with a drought, how much would you have gotten?" He said, "Like half that, like $75. And Wilson, and I'm sure he would have apologized about the cattle and everything else and let him know that he wanted to make sure it didn't happen. But he said, "You know, let me give you that, and let me give you that again," basically. So he doubled it. And the fellow took it and ended up saying, "You know, this other guy, he told me that I should do this." And he realized, you know, he shouldn't listen to that. And then you had a neighborly relation between two neighbors. Go to your adversary quickly before they take you to court. And go the extra mile. You see how that was better? It was also financially wiser. You know, "Oh yeah, we're going to fight you in court. Sometimes you may have to end up in court, but I'm going to tell you something, lawyers are the ones that get a whole lot of money when things go to court." A neighbor went to his neighbor, apologized for what happened, let him tell how much it cost him, and then doubled what it was. That's just good behavior and wise behavior. Go beyond. If they compel you to go 1 mile, go 2. And it changes you from being the oppressed. Remember, soldiers might compel you to do something like they compelled Simon of Cyrene to carry the cross. They might compel you to do this. Turn it over from your being oppressed to you choose to serve. You'll have a better day of it when you choose to serve. And pray. Matthew chapter 5, verse 44. He said, previous verse, which is not what Leviticus said, but remember, this is talking about what the Pharisees had said. The Pharisees had been saying, "Love your neighbor, hate your enemy." Jesus said, "You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor, hate your enemy." Leviticus 19 did say, love your neighbor. It didn't say, hate your enemy. By the way, you remember what the Old Testament said to do if you found your enemy's ox in the ditch? It said, get it out for him. Jesus says, love your enemies and pray for them. Pray for them to persecute you. So if you've got a neighbor and they're just, you know, "I found some rocks from your yard in my yard. You know, your tree blew some leaves over there again. You know, your squirrel scared my cat," whatever it is. If you got somebody at work, if you got somebody in your family, if you've got tension between husband and wife, siblings, whatever, pray for that person. What happens when we pray for them? Number one, we're doing what Jesus said to do. Number two, now here it's specifically, especially those that persecute us for being a Christian, but the principle applies very well to other types of conflict as well. Pray for them. It's doing what Jesus said to do. And how does your attitude change when you pray for somebody? You're not praying for that guy at work. I pray that his schemes and lies will work and he'll become the boss. No, that's not what you're praying for. You're praying for what? You're praying for him to mature and get better and learn lessons he needs and help me do the right thing here so that he can see how this works. For example, Romans chapter 12. If your enemy's hungry, feed him. You know what that's going to do? That's going to surprise him. Because when he's been poking you in the eye and he's been irritated, he's just been trying to undermine you or whatever, and then he's sick and you take him a casserole. You know, he feels bad. Because he sees, you were kind to me when I was bad to you. And be fair, Matthew 7, 1 through 5, you know this text. Start in verse 3. Why do you behold the mote that's in your brother's eye and you don't consider the beam that's in your own eye? How will you say to your brother, let me cast out the mote which is in your eye, but the beam is in yours? You hypocrite, first cast the beam out of your own eye. By the way, I've been stopping at 11:35 real regularly. I'm going to need to go a few minutes over this morning because there's several real important things here, but I'll try not to get it too much past that. Be fair. What we tend to do when we've been wronged is focus where? Look who got mistreated. And at that time, who are we not looking at and listening to? The other person's point of view. Is there usually two sides to a coin? Yes, there is. Now, don't get into an argument about percentages. Well, since it was 2% my fault and 98% yours. No, not yet. But take a hold of, if you think it was 2% you handled wrong, apologize for that 2%. If you think it was 60%, but don't put a number on it, just apologize and make right your end of it. And go overboard. Be fair. And listen, part of being fair is watching how we talk about people. You know what doesn't cause peace? Gossip. Look at Proverbs chapter 26. We're going to be having a lesson a few weeks from now on gossip. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it now, but let's mention this one verse. And I'll give you something that happened this week that was kind of interesting. Verse 20 of Proverbs 26. For lack of wood, fire goes out. Where there is no whisperer, quarreling ceases. As charcoals to hot embers, wood to fire, so is a quarrelsome man for kindling strife. The words of a whisperer are like delicious morsels that go down to the inner parts of the body. Romans 1, in the list of the sins that are worthy of death, one of the sins is backbiters. Where does a backbiter say his negative comments? Behind the other person's back. Watch how you speak about other people. If you're speaking about, if you got a brother or sister that has a problem, help them with that problem. Talk to them about it. That's where the problem is. Don't go talking around to other brethren about his problem. Now, if you've talked to him about his problem, he won't fix it, and you've taken one or two more and he still won't fix it, and you brought it before the church and he still won't fix it, then we all need to be talking about it. We need to tell him, you got to choose whether or not you're going to serve the Lord or be out. And if he won't, then he's out. But don't those... In the South, sometimes there's a thing, you know, people say, bless his heart. It's the little thing where you're kind of like letting people know, you know, watch how you talk about people. Talk well about people. If they've got a problem, talk to them. So here's what happened to me the other day. Email comes through, and it was from somebody, it was, I guess, not just national, but probably international, to a whole bunch of people about a new book. And it made a really brass statement right at the beginning. And it said that this particular thing is fiction. This entire historical belief is fiction. And now here's a new commentary. It's going to explain it all away. Well, one of the preachers that I do some activities outreach-wise wrote to me and some other preachers and said, hey, did you see this? And he was talking about this new commentary out there. So I was going to reply to him. And I was going to put, okay, here's what he said, that this entire thing is fiction and without any, you know, historical proof. And so I went to the letters from a Bithynian governor to the Roman Caesar that proved, yes, this was happening, and it's not fiction, it is real. So I put, he said this, and I put his quote, and then I put what the thing said. And I started to word it with a little bit of a jab, like so-and-so, and then describe them as like self-published author, which, you know, there's a difference between a published author. So you can have a good book that's self-published, you can have a bad book that's published. But one of the differences is, if it's self-published, there's no vetting, I just can publish it. And I started to write, self-published author said this, and then the Roman governor said this. And I thought, no, I'm not going to say that. And I just left it clean. He said this, and this said this. And then I hit send. And it went to the guy that wrote the book. You know, I was meaning to send it to the preacher that had sent it to this other group of preachers. And then I hit send and realized, oh, that didn't go to them. It went to the guy making the claim. At which point, I was glad that I caught myself and just left it. You know, he said this, and the historical fact is this. You know, here's the Roman governor's statement. And he wrote back, and he thanked me for it. He said, I'd never seen that. Nobody else had pointed out that for me before. And he said, I'm going to correct that in the commentary and different things like that. Swift to hear, slow to speak. What happens when we don't think about our words? We're just quicker to throw something in there that's not helpful. And maybe it would be good for all of us to just think about, how would I say this if this was going to go straight to them instead of a comment to somebody else? You know what? If it doesn't sound appropriate, then it's not appropriate. It's not gossip. Philippians 2, 1 through 8. We've looked at this passage many times. It's so powerful. We'll read it once more this morning. Verse 3, do nothing through faction or through vain glory, but in lowliness of mind, each counting other better than himself. Not looking each of you to his own things, but each of you also to the things of others. You remember those verses back there, agree with your adversary quickly? You remember in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 where they brethren were suing one another? What did Paul say? Don't take that to court. Pick one brother, you know, to decide on that. Gerald did a fantastic job reciting my house this past year. And I really appreciate it. Now, in between, there was a change of plans. I hadn't thought about this one section. I thought about this other. And then he said, well, would you want this? And I'm sitting there and deciding and, you know, okay, yeah, let's do this. Now, what if at the end of that, I said, oh, wait, I didn't want, and he said, well, but you said, and we'd had a disagreement. We didn't. Gerald did a great job, and I really appreciate it. But what if I felt, oh, no, that wasn't quite fair. And he thought, well, no, that's not quite fair. Okay, what does Paul say do? Me take Gerald to court? Gerald take me to court? No, choose a brother. Well, we both know Chad. He works in construction. We might say, let's ask Chad to sit down and just make a call. And Chad looks and says, I recommend this. And then you go by that. But you know what else? The other option, Paul says, just give it the other person's way. Why not be defrauded? What if Gerald says, you know, there was an extra hours spent on this and everything, but if he feels that way, I'm just going to let it slide. Or if I say, you know, I realize this, but you know, if he feels that way, I'm going to do that. That's the way it needs to be with brothers. Shingles. You don't put them there and make sure that I don't cover your territory. That's how you get leaks. Shingles overlap. So if you owe the other person a coat, overlap. Give more. You remember Zacchaeus, if I wrong somebody, I'll give back fourfold, that type of thing. Don't just look at your own point of view. Look at the other person's point of view. And we didn't have any problem. But if we had, if I stopped and realized, oh, wait a minute, yeah. Because Gerald originally said this, and then I wanted this. Oh, yeah, that cost him money. That cost him time. That cost him trouble. That cost him... See, whose view do I need to be looking at? You look at the other person's view. That's the way to do it. Practical note on apologies, forgiveness. Most of you heard this before, but it's worth repeating. There's a difference between being sorry and giving an apology and a sorry apology. Minimizing apology. Perhaps I made a mistake. Maybe my reaction wasn't the best. Well, no one's perfect after all. In other words, no big deal. Maybe I wasn't perfect. That's not an apology. There's the accusation apology. I'm sorry you got so upset over that. I'm sorry you were bothered by that. I'm sorry you took it the wrong way. In other words, here's your apology. Sorry you messed up, but it's your fault. That is not an apology. The words I'm sorry are in there, but it was an attack, not an apology. The hypothetical apology. If I may have made a mistake, if I did anything that may have appeared to be wrong, in other words, I'm admitting nothing, likely did nothing, supposing if I did, let's consider apologize for it. There's the I'm sorry, but. Well, I'm sorry, but if you hadn't, I'm sorry, but you were the one. I'm sorry, but only reacted that way because you, in other words, there's your apology. Now the real problem, you. Does that feel like an apology? That doesn't feel like an apology at all. Now you might think, yeah, but I only reacted that way because they did that. No. You might have reacted that way because you did that, but when we acted badly, it wasn't only because they did that. It includes the fact that then I chose to react badly too. Instead of returning good for evil, I decided to return evil for evil. So it may be partly their fault, but my end is all my fault. My fault. But I want them to think about what they did. Okay, then ask them to think about what they did, but don't speed by your apology and then boom in on that. Instead say, I'd like you to think about whether or not you were fair in this, but regardless of that, I know this. I was unfair. I shouldn't have said this. I shouldn't have done that. That was inconsiderate. I'm sorry. I apologize. Please forgive me. That works a lot better. And you know what? Conflict tends to produce what? Conflict. You know what humility tends to produce? Humility. Self-examination. Usually when somebody says to you, I'm sorry. I shouldn't react that way. I'm sorry. What are the words probably going to come out of your mouth? I'm sorry too. Be the one that leads in that. There's the angry apology. So I'm sorry, okay? Fine, I'm sorry. Are you satisfied? That's not an apology. The prodigal son shows how to apologize. He said, I'm going to go to my father and I'm going to say, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight. Not worthy to be your son. And he goes, and the father is so happy to see him, but he goes ahead and says what he needs to say. I've sinned against heaven and in your sight. And he receives mercy. Let's close again with James 3. James chapter 3. Who is wise, verse 13, and understanding among you? Let him show by his good life his works and meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and faction in your heart, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom is not a wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish. For where jealousy and faction are, there is confusion and every vile deed. The wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy, good fruits, without variance, without hypocrisy. For the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace for them that make peace. Let's be better at being peacemakers. They're the ones that would be blessed. If you need to respond to the Lord who has offered peace to you, the peace that he made possible by paying our penalty for, why don't you come as you stand and sing?